Hi, dear.
I have a quick question for you.
Yeah, what's up?
All right. Why is it that guys are so adverse to wearing, like, dancer's belts or, like, compression shorts if they're wearing, like, a bodysuit?
Oh, you're imagining, like, a Spider-Man cosplayer.
Or, like okay, so pictures from Katsukon are coming out, like, on Instagram and TikTok and everything. And I've seen one too many dudes that forgot that they are not an animation drawing wearing Spider-Man are these really tight suits. And I need to know why.
I can only imagine that there's like a degree of discomfort with it. I thankfully have been blessed with cosplays that are loose fitting. So I can't really say from personal experience. Does a jockstrap count as something that would that be helpful?
Yeah, it'd be better than nothing.
Okay. I know that the dancer's belt is something that was floated in recent history.
Yes. So me and so many hoodies have talked about multiple times as like previous dancers. What a dancer's belt is basically, it's a type of underwear that like men can tuck their stuff into.
That was great.
Yeah. When traditionally ballet dancing, because you are very intimately close and also wearing tights, and it makes you look a bit like a Ken doll.
No, I think that's ideal. I think, is a dancer's belt ever used for drag performances at all? Or
no, because it's not
that's other tucking.
That's tucking. That's tape and tucking.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah, they duct tape it back.
Wow.
Yeah. Nothing like duct tape. All right, everyone. Welcome to Cosplay Con Crunch. I am your host, Cosplay Cajun. And as always, I am joined by...
I am Ryan. You can find me on Instagram as ActualRye96.
All right. So we are talking this week about the less glamorous parts about making cosplay, because last week we got to talk about all the glamorous parts of KatsuCon behind the scenes, but I feel like this week we need to talk about kind of the barriers to entry when it comes to cosplaying. Ryan and I take on two separate parts of cosplay creation. I do sewing and foam work. Ryan does 3D modeling and printing, as well as all of our painting, which I think I don't sing enough praise about because we live in New England, and a lot of our big cons are not warm times for us. So Ryan is outside in the cold spray painting into the nigh early mornings.
Oh, it's tragic. I think that spray painting and painting in general is something that I can really improve on. Mm-hmm. But I will say, and this may just be my cope, that my copium, which is that the cold weather does make it harder for spray paint to bond. So it's both painful for me and sad for our props sometimes. But, you know, we try our best to make it work. So
if only I could decide what we were doing, if we could decide what we were doing, like in July.
And get everything printed and painted by then.
Everything printed and painted by like October and just not think about it for the rest of the year.
Yeah, like no such thing as a KatsuCon crunch when you're done in October.
Well, at least not for the probs.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess.
I'd still be con crunching. And there'd still be something that I'd be like, hey, dear, I need you to do this.
There'd always be something, yeah.
So I know a couple people that will do stuff inside, but Ryan has the logical fear of cancer.
Wow, it's actually maybe the most logical. I've seen people who work with foam, and it's always a little bit, you know, off-putting to me when I see them like heat gunning this like project foam inside, and people talk about
he may or may not be talking about me.
Yeah, people talk about the smell that is associated with heat gunning foam. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't be able to smell it. You shouldn't have to know what cancer smells like personally. But
I mean, you hate the smell. You hate contact cement more than anything.
Well, at least contact cement smells like yes. That's what glue is supposed to smell like. Like that's, you know, when the old like, oh, that guy, he doesn't know what's going on. He's huffing glue. That's contact cement. That's what it is. It's when you huff glue.
That just brought back a really strong memory from like fourth grade about like what we took on a weird field trip to like a health center where they told us, they showed us the creepiest video of what happens when you huff spray paint and glue. And I was like, this seems irrelevant for a 9-year-old, but whatever.
Yeah, I think the fear back then was one of don't vandalize. But like, I don't know, and it just kind of stopped mattering. I mean, you interact with kids on a more regular basis, so I don't know, maybe you can tell me, are they vandalizing?
I cannot confirm nor deny if students are vandalizing.
Oh, boy.
I also cannot confirm deny whether or not I'd encourage them to vandalize.
Oh, that's neither here nor there, though. So,
neither here nor there.
All right.
All right. So on today's subject, Ryan and I have a list of questions that we've prepared for each other. As we kind of mentioned in our first episode, we don't understand each other's crafts, like, at all.
I think that that's a bit reductive. Over the course of the past 2 years, we've tried our best to kind of reach across the aisle.
Yeah, and there's still a pretty big aisle, though.
I guess. Yeah, you could definitely say that. But we're doing our best to get to a place of more mutual understanding. So this podcast may be one of those avenues.
Just like by the final end of this, I understand how 3D modeling works and you understand how to like sew a rolled seam.
It's like that Danny DeVito meme when you zoom in on it. It's just like, I get it.
Is that an Always Sunny reference?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't get it. I'm not Danny DeVito.
I'm not Danny DeVito.
All right. So, dear, would you like to ask me questions first or do you want me to ask you questions first?
Yeah, I guess I can go first.
Okay. What is your first question, darling?
Yeah, I think that this is one that comes to mind most immediately because it may not be the most fundamental question, but it may be the most relevant one.
Oh, no.
Right. So I think we should talk about fasteners, right? I know that my Shanks buttons kept popping off, which was the main thing that made me think about this.
Okay.
So what would you say are the best fasteners, the most reliable ones? And when should you use certain fasteners versus others?
What is the most reliable fastener? If you ask me, a closed seam.
Okay, well.
Like, yeah, something that has no fasteners is the most reliable fastener, as always. After that, I think the big thing, it depends on the fabric that you're working with. Like, if you're working with, like, several layers of a really thick fabric, then probably grommets and, like, lacing works really well because all of that fabric is so thick that, like, the grommets have something to grip onto. Grommets are, like, little metal rings that you put in corsets mostly. You can also use a buttonhole as, like, a loop for corseting. That's what I did for my Odette corset. After that, zippers, because you can machine sew them down.
It's starting to sound like the best fasteners are ones that are more directly related to just a solid sewed in thing.
Yes. No. So that's like the thing of it's like buttons. The buttons that I was using. So there are buttons that you can machine sew down. Right. They are the ones that have like holes facing outward, which I wasn't smart enough to get for your pants. I could probably go out and get new buttons and do that. But it's the thing of it's like, which one do you feel is more reliable, hand sewing or machine sewing? And the answer is almost always machine sewing.
Yeah.
Because it's just better. Like, there's a reason other than like speed we created in sewing machines. Like, it's stronger because you're using a two-threaded system, which is the thread and the bobbin. But like, even on top of that, like, buttonholes are made exclusively by machines unless like you're hand sewing eyelets for historical purposes. And even that can rip if you're not careful. Like if you're cutting them out wrong, you can completely cut through a buttonhole and then you just gotta fix it. Unfortunately, like zippers are the best. The problem with zippers is that means you gotta know how to put in a zipper.
MJ is underselling themselves. They know how to put in a zipper. They just don't like it.
I didn't for a really long time. And that kind of shows the fact that my mom hates putting in zippers because everything I learned from my mom and my grandmother. So I have like no classical training. And so I got to, at the age of 24, call my mom on the phone and yell at her for never teaching me how to put in a zipper.
This is fair.
Ryan got to
Can
watch.
You imagine like just MJ and their mom just on the phone, kind of yelling back and forth. And remember, there's no visual demonstration here. It's all just like audio. It's just, and then you do this and I'm just like, what are you talking about? And it's like, oh boy. Oh Jesus.
And then it turns out that there's a special foot that makes it easier. And then once I figured that out, oh my God, I put zippers in everything now.
Yeah. No, zippers are great. I like
it. It was the Sophie dress that killed me because it had to be an invisible zipper. And then I fixed, and then by the time I did so many hoodies, Perona skirt, I just had it down.
Just a full down zipper.
Yeah. It's up down in the back. I looked at them and I was like, do you want me to do this or do you want to do this? And they were like, why don't you do it and show me and then I will do it. And so I showed them. And so now they know in theory.
In theory.
In theory. I also gave them a zipper foot to make it easier.
What? I guess here's my follow-up question. Imagine dress pants, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, on dress pants, they have a zipper and they also have one of those hooks.
Yeah.
At the top. What is that called? Those seem pretty low profile.
Those are hook eyelets.
Okay.
There's another one that kind of looks like it that's called a hook and eye. And so the backwards facing ones that you're thinking of with the flat like thing that they hook into.
Yeah.
It again goes back to how are you sewing it to the garment?
Right, right. Because how do you think they do it for?
For mass marketing?
Yeah.
They have a machine that does it.
They just goes like and just like secures it in place.
Nope. What it will do is it will stitch it back and forth. So there's two holes. Uh-huh. At the back of it, if you ever pull out your dress pants, you'll see that there's like it's sewn in by two eyelets. So in theory, you can rip it out kind of like a button. You can set up a machine that will sew back and forth that distance between the entry points on the hook. You can do the same thing on a dress form hook and eyelet, which I use for my Odette skirt. That's the thing that's on that. Traditionally, I've always hand sewn them. And then I realized that I didn't have to be that stupid. And then I started machine sewing them.
Oh, okay. That sounds good. Because I look at those and like this sort of came up when I was putting on the Shanks pants. I grab by the fastener because that's what I'm used to on mass marketed, you know, clothes. I just grab by like, I'll grab by the button and I'll pull it out and I'll put it into its slit.
Yeah, because that's what I'm used to. Pull by the slit and put it on the button.
Yeah, that's to me. I mean, to be fair, I can't remember when I was taught to put pants on. I just remember being able to.
You just remember being able to do pants.
I just remember, I don't have like a formative memory of putting pants on for the first time though.
Yeah.
So.
When did you switch from elastic to buttons?
Brother, I have no idea.
No, I know. But here's the thing. Like if you have like a thin, like chiffon fabric, you can't do buttons because the fabric's not thick enough to do buttonholes.
So what's the best way to secure something thin like that?
Elastic.
I see.
So you would make an elastic band in it.
Right.
So like if you think about my like really flowy white Renaissance shirt, there's an elastic that is sewn into it.
I see.
And that's it.
I think your mom was very into the idea of just throwing an elastic band in there.
That's my mom's solution to everything. I call her for like, hey, I need to gather this. How should I do it? And she's like, oh, make a channel, put elastic into it. That'll gather it. I'm like, no, Sharon, that's not the answer. I can't. There's buttons and it has like a back where like you have to put grommets in it. And she's like, oh, well, double baste it and do that. And I'm like, I hate this.
Just do the elastic, put a cosmetic button.
Cosmetic button. All right. So that's, I guess, did that answer the question?
I think so. I think
the answer is none of them is perfect. You have to know what fabric you're working with, which is very frustrating.
That's fair. That's fair.
All right. So my first question for you is, what is the hardest part about taking a prop we see on TV, especially animated, and designing it? Because you've now had to design a couple different props.
Just like from ground up.
From ground up. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the first thing that I look at when I see a prop on TV is I guess I think about the property that it's from. Yeah. Right? I'm like, well, I think the best idea that I can think of from like ground design to realization was probably the Tesaiga, which is the
Inuyasha's blade,
the big sword from Inuyasha. And I like remember that I wasn't super big on the Inuyasha show, but I know that
I just wanted to be the dog boy.
MJ really wanted to be Inuyasha.
I really wanted to be that dog.
And so I was like, that's fine. I was like, does he come with any like props associated with him? And MJ was like, oh, I'm glad that you asked. He's got this sword. And I'm like, that's great. Let me see the sword. And like, honestly, you know what would be great, right? This is what I thought when I saw Inuyasha's sword. the Tessaiga is no consistent size.
No, it's not.
It's no.
It literally shrinks to go in its sheath.
Yeah, it comes out gigantic and then it shrinks and goes in a little baby sheath. And I'm like, that makes no sense at all. I don't think that when we finished the prop, right, we didn't even have a sheath for it.
No, it doesn't. It does not have a sheath because we couldn't figure out how to get it in one.
Yeah, I'd have to design like a shrinking. Nah. Just nah. How about that? Nah. So, no, but the Inuyasha sword was interesting because what I basically did was I looked at it and I was like, it can be as big as like a cloud buster, right? Mm-hmm. But it can also just be as small as just like a regular, like
samurai sword.
Right. It could be whatever, really. And so I kind of like split the difference and I made the sword about 2.5, 3 feet. Right?
2.5.
Yeah. 2.5 feet in total length, because my thought process was that is
much nagging for me to make it bigger.
Yeah, come on, you can go bigger. One more. I'm like, well, I'd like it to be in as few pieces as possible. So that's all right. So to really think about the design of a weapon or prop from ground up, you have to think about how big is it going to be when it's done. Mm-hmm. And also how many different pieces are you willing to have this prop be made in, right? So I decided that with my current 3D printer, mm-hmm, I wanted it to be made in about three separate pieces, right? Like three separate pieces for blade. Mm-hmm. And then I think one handle piece, right? And then I would take each of those pieces and I would fuse them together.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you have to think about then is, what is the size of my build plate, right? How big can I possibly print this thing? And on instinct, right, one would think, I'm going to print this because it's a blade from top to bottom, right? From like basically like the handle cross section to like the very tip of the blade in a very like Z direction, right?
Yeah.
But
build it up.
Build it from ground to literally up.
Yeah.
And that's something that I've just, you know, in thinking about how these like slicing softwares will like cut up these things, I'm like, there's going to be a very clear grain with which if you swing this sword, it'll just snap. It could snap at any one of those little like points. So one of the things that you think about when you're designing these things is, how big do you want it to really be? How many pieces are you willing to have it separate into? And this is something that I should have thought about when I was designing Tessaiga. What support structure should I put in it, right? Because an adequate support structure within the sword itself would have made it so that the sword had integrity independent of its grain.
Yeah.
Right? Because now we created Yoru, which is the biggest the biggest prop that I've ever made. Right?
69 inches!
Which is, yeah, I'm going to go with literally 69 inches.
It's taller than I am.
In length. And I didn't have to really worry about the grain in Yoru because I had so much support structure in it. We're talking about it actually was one inch PVC running down the middle, and it wasn't the soft PVC, but it was like the electrical PVC, which is a little bit harder.
Yeah.
And then it had two wooden dowels also running down the middle. Mm-hmm. So that was just for the blade support itself.
Because the blade is the big part.
The blade is also the part where I would look at it and I'd be like, this is like gonna take the most like force because of how you hold it, right? When you hold the sword from its handle, right, out in the way that you were in our photos, right?
Basically, what I was doing is I was grabbing it and I was one-handed pointing it at people.
Yeah.
Fully extended, as like if I was using a pointer with my arm.
Yeah. The one-handed torque from the weight of the sword itself, right, is all geared at like the center of mass of that sword, wherever it is, right? And that center of mass dictates.
We found it, and it's like right after
the handle, which is so frustrating. Yeah, I'm so upset. I wanted it to be at the handle, right? And so to try to facilitate that, I made it so that each of the handle bits were printed at a higher density, right, than all of the sword bits, right?
Sense.
And so all the sword bits at the very tip of that sword is only 8% infill, and the handle was 25.
Can you explain what that means?
So the infill density for a prop, for any 3D print really, is how full the plastic model is. Because all you see as a person who is looking at a 3D prop Is the outside is solid. This is a piece of plastic, but the inside is like a lattice. Usually it's a square, kind of like cubic lattice of just.
But hexagon is bestagon.
Actually, you can select hexagon, but it's hard for hexagons to, like, I don't know. It's hard for them to do small hexagons, like
shout
really
out to
small
CP
ones.
CPG gray.
CGP gray.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. But So if you increase the infill density, basically
it's thick. It's more solid.
It's more thicker. Solid. Yeah. It's more filled with plastic material, okay. Right? So if you could also, this is the best example. Mm-hmm. You could have something printed at 0% infill, which is just a shell, a completely hollow shell.
And you could do that for like molding.
Like, I guess, yeah.
We could do that for molding. And molding, you can use a couple different things. You can use foam clay, or you can use, what is the other thing? Hot glue. You can use really good hot glue for molding.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. The other thing I would do for a mold is I would just take one model and I'd print it at normal infill for the structure, and I just split it in half. And then I would just print it in two pieces. Because I think that's just better. But I don't know. That's a different thing. So,
different question for later.
Either way, what are the things that I think about? I think the biggest determining factor is how big is this prop going to be? And also, and here's another big one. Will it have an electronic component to it? Because a lot of the times our props might, right?
Yeah.
Especially these days, right? As they start to get more elaborate. And then you have to think about, will this prop be more functional, right, for the electronic to work? Or will this prop be more visual so that it comes out in pictures better? And I think it's finding a way to strike a harmony between those two things, functional and aesthetic.
That was a big thing we struggled with when we started, because you wanted them to be more functional than visual.
Yeah, yeah. I would definitely say so. But I feel like, you know, I can get more into that later.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
Cool. All right. So let's see. I have another thing for you.
I would hope.
Okay. So we're pretty privileged to have a very nice sewing machine now.
Yes.
And I was there when we bought it. It's actually very nice. The guy did the whole sales pitch for us.
Yeah. And then we left. And then the next day he was like, oh, you guys actually came back? Here's a bag full of shit.
Yeah. What would you say is a nice introductory machine that people who are just getting into cosplay would be able to afford and maybe interested in getting?
So, okay, there's a couple. I think the biggest thing is finding a reasonable place to get them at. Joann's always has coupons for everything.
Yeah, you have to have like a Joann's app.
Yeah, you have to have a Joann's app, or you could just Google them. And normally they have like a 30 or a 40% off one regularly priced item. Honestly, there's kind of, when you're starting, only three things that you really need on a sewing machine. You need a zigzag stitch, you need a straight stitch, and you need a reverse pedal. And so any machine that has those three things, which is every machine, I would say the number one thing is to not get an electronic machine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As your first machine, you should not have a machine that has like a computer like mine does.
Right.
Because it's just a really good way to get yourself confused.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the two that I really think are best, because they're under $150 and they're pretty good, is I have a Genome, a very high quality sewing machine, but even their like lowest one, which is the easy to use sewing machine, and it also comes in a really fun color, is a really good one. Or the other one, if you have like a little bit more, which is only $150, is the Singer 2277, which is like the traditional one. And I think the biggest thing with that is just getting yourself familiar with being in control of the machine itself, because neither of them have push start sewing machines. They both have like, they're pedal controlled, and they both have very informative like user guides and how to use things, and they have the ability to be subbed out without the traditional pedals, such as like a rolled hem foot or a zipper foot and all of these other things that, like, you can get used to using, but also you don't need them to use those machines.
So you had to acquire a separate zipper foot, right? Or did you already have one? I was confused on that.
So my original sewing machine was a Brother that I had had since...
Brother?
Yeah.
Yeah, whoa.
I don't...
Almost derogatory.
No, it's mostly just the fact that it was like 15, 20 years old. Oh. It was one that my mom got me and my sister, like she got us each one when I was probably like 7. And it was just the machine I was required to use for the rest of my life. And then I inherited a Better Home one from my grandmother. And that thing is called Gertrude because it is a behemoth and also probably from the 80s. But it came with a bunch of feet, including a zipper foot and a couple others. And I was like, oh my God, this is the best thing in the world. And then for my birthday one year, my sister got me the Madam Stitches 32 kits, like different feet. And I think I've used maybe 5 of them because I don't have a purpose for the other 25.
25, yeah.
Wow. And not to say that like I'll never have a purpose, I just haven't yet. And that is how I got another zipper foot. And then when we bought this one, it came with a bunch of feet as part of the, like, here's a bag full of shit thing that the guy gave us.
Right.
And that included another zipper foot.
Oh my gosh. So we've got a bit of a surplus.
And a bunch of other feet as well, such as like a gathering foot, which I've never gotten to work in my entire life. Gathering feet are awful.
You got to do a manual.
You got to just manually do it. I've never found a way to get around it. Everyone's like, yeah, use a gathering foot. I've never seen one work.
Damn. Well, so I guess to kind of zoom out a little bit, you'd recommend those two sewing machines that you mentioned before?
Yeah. So the Singer 2277 and the Genome, like, Easy to Sew.
Yeah. Why is it that you recommend they have those three stitch patterns specifically?
Okay. So that is because you need a straight stitch to sew things together. You need a zigzag stitch to sew stretch fabrics together. And you need a reverse pedal, which is on every machine, to finish and start every seam.
Gotcha.
So basically, when you're sewing something together to make sure that the fabric doesn't just, like, the stitch just doesn't come apart as you, like, move and it gets pulled on, you backtrack, which is the back, like, the reverse pedal. You backtrack to, like, it's called, like, backing up the seam, kind of. And so you backtrack like a couple stitches and then go forward. I backtrack way too many stitches because I'm never secure in whether or not my clothing is secure. But that's like what you do to, like,
erring on the side of caution is never a bad thing.
Until you have to seam rip it.
And then it's really hard.
And then you come to me and go, MJ, what happened? And I'm like, oh, just start in the middle and work backwards.
It's so hard to get the seam rip to start. I think that once it's begun, I can get through it. But it's hard for me, who doesn't know what I'm looking at sometimes. And for sometimes the invisible seams. Like, they're, like, those the same color as the fabric.
Oh, the intentionally, like, I finally learned how to match thread to fabric. Like,
oh,
yeah.
No, I can't do this.
I did that to you for Mihawk's coat one time, and you were like, happened? And I'm like, I don't know what you're complaining about.
And that's my favorite thing, is that there's not really any way to seam rip automatically. You just have to do it manually. It's like a walk of shame, almost.
Yeah, and it takes forever, and that's why I make you do it, so I can continue working on other things.
Yeah. So.
Oh my gosh, the amount of seam ripping I had to do when I was making Hal's jacket because I sewed the panels together wrong.
Nobody notices. It's just you.
No, it wouldn't. It physically wouldn't match together. I couldn't, like, finish it.
Oh.
Yeah. Did I answer your question, though?
No, I think that that's pretty good. I think that it's important for us to, especially for those who are just starting to get into cosplay, have somewhere to look. Because if you just look up beginner sewing machines, you'll find some, like, BuzzFeed article or whatever. And I don't think that that's necessarily reliable or backed by experience, really.
I think the other major thing is that, like, you'll find a lot of, like, really cheap sewing machines.
Like, from more unknown brands and
stuff. Or even from, like, known brands. Like, Singer makes, like, a $20 sewing machine. It's shit. But they do make it.
One project per use.
Oh my God, kind of.
Single-use machine.
But yeah, so my kind of next question for you is,
all right,
what kind of prop do you absolutely dread making? And you can't say the AOT gear.
Ooh, that's a good question. The kind of prop that I dread making. Mm-hmm. I guess I think that for me, Ryan, this may be just like a personal hang up on my end. The idea of making like an Iron Man armor, right? Mm-hmm. That's too much. Because so much of like the Iron Man armor is like, you know, I know in the first movie they made it like practical, right? And he had like a suit that he would put on, mm-hmm. right? But everything after that, it's just become like CGI. And so there's like a guy that I see plenty of 3D printing. Builds. Yeah, Frankly Builds on Instagram.
And YouTube now.
I see so much stuff from him, and he's got like the most beautiful, like well-made, polished Iron Man suits that I've ever seen. You can't see the seams in them. It's perfect. I've actually learned so much from watching his videos.
Yeah.
That being said, there is something so agonizing just for me to think about, like, okay, not only have you made Iron Man gear that fits exactly your body at exactly that particular moment in time.
Oh, yeah, because that's basically form-fit to you.
Completely, mm-hmm. right? It's completely form-fit to you, and it has electronics inside of it, mm-hmm. right?
They're all in the back.
And let me tell you, oh, I know, yeah. But even then, like, they're still pretty well hidden.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I've seen, like, side shots, and I can't tell that there are electronics back there, mm-hmm. right? He's got like batteries in it and stuff like that to power like the lights and everything like that.
Because it moves.
Right, because it moves and it makes noises and all of that stuff. And like the helmet is even like actuated. Oh, it's sick, dude. It's really cool. But the idea that you make it, it all goes together. And then one, like say like one small electronic bit inside of it fails, right? Now you have to dissect it.
Oh, so it's the upkeep for you.
It's the upkeep. It would be a type of prop or suit or something like that that requires a substantial amount of upkeep to rewear. Well, of course, the first one is form fit to you, right? And only you. Mm-hmm. And something that like is not easy to get inside of. Specifically because for stuff like that, you are so meticulous in how you're polishing it and painting and doing this and everything that you don't want to take it apart. Right? Because if you now have to get in there, right, if something like cracks or breaks, now you have to either print an entirely new piece and then put it back on there, or you have to print a whole new like limb. Like a whole new limb. Another
print your arm.
To move past Iron Man. Also stuff like animatronic type characters from like Five Nights at Freddy's.
Oh,
stuff like
Freddy
that.
Freddy Fazbear broke my back plate.
Yeah, so I have a little bit of resentment there. So stuff
for
like
reference, when we were at RICC in 2023, we were in the first rendition of the season 4 Attack on Titan gear, and animatronic Freddy Fazbear bumped my back and broke off the connection piece for how the like gears connected. And I then had to spend like 45 minutes at cosplay repair. And they were like, yeah, I don't really know enough. Thanks, Nance. And turns out screws and hot glue.
Yeah. And so this is actually another, this brings up another point, like a sub point to this question, which is that what I've learned in like, at least especially in the most recent rendition of the Attack on Titan stuff, and with Yoru, my big sword, once you've finished and like, I mean like post-printing, like you've sanded and you've primed, you've painted and you've like put together your pieces, when like a break happens, you now no longer can go in and fuse those pieces together. So when I say fusion, what I'm talking about is, and this is again, a technique I learned from Frankly Builds, God bless him.
God bless that man.
He takes in his words, a cheap soldering iron that you don't care about, and you just like run it.
You don't use a cheap soldering iron.
No, because I like controlling the temperature. but I'll take our cheap one with us.
Yeah, you do.
So the thing you'll do is you'll take a soldering iron, you'll put two plastic pieces together, and then you'll run the soldering iron along the seam, right? And what you're basically doing is you're burning the seam together to basically make the two separate plastic pieces behave as though they are one. And if you've printed them along the similar grain, right, they do behave like one. So with the Tessaga, which broke along its handle, right, mm-hmm. which was, I think, along some of the grains that I had made.
Yeah.
That made sense. But then I think it also broke along the Z-axis, which did not make as much sense to me. And it wasn't along one of, like, the fused lines, which, crazy. That just goes to show that when you do fuse something properly, it does hold. But once you've painted and primed and done everything to it, the second that you try to fuse it back together, the paint, the prime, the wood filler, whatever it is that you've put in there will get in the way of making that perfect plastic on plastic fusion happen. Because you want to just make it so that the plastic is fused together. Mm-hmm. You don't want the paint or the primer or whatever else to get in the way of that fusion. Nope. And so what you'll find happen is that you'll try to go back in there after something's broken off and you try to put it back together with fusion and it's weaker. It's so much weaker. It might stay for a little bit. It's weaker. It's not going to work. You need to move to something else. You need to move to hot glue, contact cement, maybe super glue. If you had nothing else, you can't rely on fusion anymore. And so the idea that you've made an entire like body type build, mm-hmm. right? And something breaks in a place that you don't intend, that's not easy to fix, agonizing. So don't want to do that.
Okay, so I can never get into like a mech anime.
You can like cosplay the character. If, like, you ever did like Samus, if you're ever into like Samus or something like that, you could be the Zero Suit version.
I'm not allowed to be the suit version of the cooler version of Samus.
Yeah, I mean, but like, that suit's a lot, man. That suit would
There's also like a lot of gaps in it, though.
Yeah, actually, that Samus may be the one like suit build that yeah. I might be open to because of its
gapping.
It's got fun gapping and it's very recognizable. And I'm just like, well, I could try it. That'll be like, I could try.
It's like football gear, kind of, with like shin guards.
Yeah, people have probably made it with that in mind. All right. Kind of in tandem with the last question. So I know that we have a Surger.
Yeah.
Do you have plans to bust it out for any future cosplay plans? And more importantly, what would you use it for?
Oh, God. I love how often this Surger comes up in conversation, seeing as that it's never been used in our home. So, all right. First things first. A Surger is a sewing machine that utilizes four threads and a blade to clean edges of interior seams. What it does is as you run it through, it basically makes a really intricate stitch pattern to make it so that the fabric can't fray and also doesn't like rub up against you raw and is cut straight. So the blade cuts off any excess and the stitch makes it so that like every seam is covered. If you want an example of what a serge stitch is, grab your shirt and turn and look at the interior stitch that stitches the front and the back together. That is a serged stitch. Point two. Ours is busted.
Oh, jeez. Well, I thought that the main thing was
busted. It's just supply. Oh, well, I also lost the pedal, so that didn't help. But it's old. It is my grandmother's from, we think, the 90s. But we're not sure. It's yellow. It didn't start yellow. It was white. At one point, and it got so dirty from being in southwestern Louisiana, just was existing.
Was it a good machine in its prime?
I have no idea.
Oh, wow.
To my mother, yes, but that's because it's solid metal on the inside.
Your mom may be biased.
No, my mom craps on grandma's stuff enough.
Oh, wow. So this might actually be pretty solid.
Yeah. So it is currently getting fixed. I sent an offer. Maintenance, which is a thing that you just have to do with your sewing machine every couple months or years, depending on how often you use it. Another thing I learned, you're supposed to change out your needle every project.
For a serger.
For every machine.
Huh. I remember when your needle was dull.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to sew Mihawk's jacket together.
Yeah.
And it was one, squeaking, and two, it wouldn't stab through. And I'm like, what is going on here? Turns out I dulled the needle by using it so much.
Yeah.
So yeah, change out your needles regularly. Do I have the intention of using it? Of course. Of course I do. For kind of its purpose, which is every interior seam. Why would you use a serger instead of a sewing machine? Skill.
I see.
You have to...
It's a completely set of, like, new skills.
Yeah, because here's the thing. A serger cuts fabric. So if I make something too small, but I left seam allowance on a normal stitch, which is basically just, like, you sew things together further than when the end of the fabric is. So if I think I might need to let it out and make it bigger, I would sew an inch seam rather than 3/8, which is standard. Now, what does that look like? That looks like I throw pants at you and say, try these on. And then you go, MJ, they're too small. And then I seam rip the seams and stitch them closer to the edge. Have you try them on again? And you go, these fit fine. And I go, okay, great. The reverse is also true. Like, I have given you things and you've looked at me and gone, MJ, this is way too big. And I go, oh, shoot. And then I just stitch them closer together. I take them in and cut off the excess and give them to you. And you go, yeah, these are fine. I've done that for myself as well. There's just no commentary because I'm putting it on myself.
Right, right. Internal, actually.
And sometimes it's external. You're just not around to hear it. You don't really get that with a serger because you're cutting fabric as you go. You have to know that you are at best making it too big. And then you would just serge it again. But then that'd be kind of a waste of thread because serger thread is expensive because it's these huge dowels and you need 4 of them to run the machine. So, like, the purpose of the serger would be, like, when I'm stitching things together and, like, for your shank shirt, instead of having those raw edges on the inside, I would serge that. And what would that do? Win me brownie points at, like, a cosplay contest.
Which we should really start to enter at this point.
We really should. Problem is, I have to keep entering as a group.
Yeah.
Turns out, so for those of you who are curious, cosplay contests a lot of times have you require, if you had any assistance, like if Dan does dress up, does my wig, they have to enter with me as my wig stylist. And they will ask me questions about my wig. And so it's hard to lie. Like, even if, like, you know the person that did it, it's really difficult. So for Ryan and I really wanted to enter a couple. And I'm like, but I have to have Ryan because there's, like, one or two props that I just don't. Like, Mihawk, I need you to enter as Shanks as well. Because I'm like, I don't know anything about this sword. I know it's big. I know it's big.
You know that it took about 200 hours.
I know it took about 200 hours. And I know...
Just on print.
That the handle may have broken. That's the purpose of a serger. The answer is yes. The answer is also I've only used it because it didn't work.
Nice. Okay.
Okay. So my next question for you is, what is one thing about prop making that is the most difficult to get into?
Most difficult to get into?
Yeah.
What makes
propping so hard?
I think the thing that was maybe a huge barrier to entry before.
Mm-hmm.
Was acquiring a 3D printer. Okay. It used to be, but nowadays...
You just bought one for $50.
Yeah, I did. I found a 3D printer just on Marketplace, which is like an older version of the one that I have. And I was like, this guy's never used this printer before. So I'm just going to scoop it. I'm going to scoop it up. So, no, it used to be that 3D printers were like... There were two companies that made 3D printers. It was MakerBot and then like Ultimaker, right? And those were the two big like 3D printer like companies. Oh, and Prusa. Prusa is also very big.
Prusa is the like German one that's like $600, right?
Oh, and it's great. I can never sell you on Prusa because I'm like, well, what do we get with Prusa? I'm like, so it prints slower. The bed is smaller.
Yeah.
But it's better.
It's better in every way.
I promise.
It doesn't sound it. It sounds slower and smaller.
It sounds worse, actually, in every way. And it's 3 times the price.
So expensive. I looked into one.
Yeah. There's oh, and also it's on back order. Every Prusa I...
No, like, you're really selling this, dude.
Every Prusa, like, was like Mark III or something, is on back order. So if you order the printer today, it'll take 3 weeks minimum for it to be like shipped here. And it won't even, this is my favorite thing. I looked at them back when we were trying to get our first 3D printer back when we lived in Florida at this point. God. My dad and I really wanted one. And we were going to get it. And we looked at the 3 to 6 week back order. And we were like, nah. And I thought that was only for, because they also will sell them fully assembled.
Mm-hmm.
Right? No. it doesn't matter. They'll sell the kit that you have to put together yourself in 3 to 6 weeks. I'm like, that's crazy.
Is it cheaper to buy the kit?
Yeah. It's $150 cheaper.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's $600. The other one's $750. Fully assembled is $750.
Really selling this
one. No, man, it's just, I just know that it's better in every way. And it comes with fun accessories that make it so that you can print in multiple filaments and stuff like that. But that's a separate thing. Anyways, no. So it used to be the 3D printers were the part of the process that was the least accessible. But nowadays, you could buy an Ender 3, right? For like $150 to $200, depending on whatever promotion they're running, right? And you can buy filament for like $15 to $25, depending on what filament you're working with. So it used to be that that was a barrier to entry, but you could find a model online, pay $5 for it, or even find free models on like Thingiverse, right? And print entire builds that other people have designed. I think the hardest part, is your question, what is the hardest part about this process?
Yeah.
I think the hardest adjustment, probably for most people, will be learning a CAD program, right? So CAD is just computer-assisted design, right? Super general term. And there are so many different CAD softwares out there, right? There's AutoCAD, right? Which is mostly like a drafting software. There's SolidWorks, which is what I use. Oh, there's Blender.
That one.
Blender is more of like an art-based sculpture type software. And the thing that's fun about Blender is that it's got so many different, like, it's open source. So you can go and find different like modifications to like the add-ons to like the Blender software to do exactly what it is that you want. You can just start with like a piece of clay and then like mold it in Blender and go from there. I've never done that because I'm not necessarily as artistically inclined. I like the precision of a more SolidWorks type parametric program, right? I think that for a person who wants to get into prop making, the ability to learn a CAD software and commit to that CAD software is probably the hardest part. I am very fortunate that we have access to SolidWorks because MJ's a student, right?
Yeah, so how much is SolidWorks without
a student? Oh, it's like $800. But then you own it. $800 and you own it outright. But right now we have the student edition and we pay, I think now it's down to like $100 a year, which is not nothing. That is not nothing at all. I use it constantly, right? Like every convention season I'm using SolidWorks. But you have to remember that like you can't just buy SolidWorks. You need to learn how to use the most recent version of SolidWorks if you want to use it practically. There are classes, like YouTube University is definitely a thing. My brother is the one who taught me how to use it, though, properly. And that's something that he learned when he was in high school, just in like a really good engineering program. So I don't know. You gotta know somebody who knows CAD to be able to teach you how to design things in CAD. Because at some point, I could theoretically teach MJ how to use like these CAD programs. Just like how MJ could teach me how to sew. But like, it's gonna be sloppy at first.
I'll be bad at it.
Yeah, and I'm not a great teacher. So it's one of those things where it's like you kind of need to find randomly just a good teacher and or a YouTube series. Yeah, or like a YouTube series or a library classes or something that will teach you how to use a program that works. And it doesn't have to be SolidWorks.
All right. It looks like we have just enough time for one more question each. So what's your last burning question, darling?
Oh, it's actually similar to one of your questions.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Is there an era or style that you refuse to learn how to sew in? I'm thinking like Victorian, like classic Victorian, or maybe, and this one is another one I was thinking, just modern streetwear, right? I'm curious. Is there just one era that you're just, that's a hard no, that's too different from what I know?
Okay. So I think the big thing is, I'm not willing to do, like, the historically accurate costuming. That is one big barrier to entry for me. Of, like, I'm looking at it and I'm like, why would I use my fingers and, like, tiny, tiny needles and pins when I can just use my machine that's so quickly.
Wait, so like, are there certain designs that require you to hand sew? Oh, okay.
No.
So what are you referring to?
So historically accurate is for historical like reenactment and Renaissance fairs.
You're telling me that those people make those like without a sewing machine?
Sometimes, yeah.
Oh my God.
And there's a couple people that like, I think there's one girl on TikTok right now that is making the Elizabeth Swan dress historically accurate. And so like she hand stitched all of the buttons for the, like the chemise, which is the underdress. And I'm like, no, one, it's the underdress. Two, do you know how many stitches that is? Oh God, would that take forever? And you have to like tie off your knots in specific ways and your thread has to be a certain thickness and all of this other stuff. And I'm just like, not happening.
No, that makes sense.
I think the other point that you kind of touched on with like traditional streetwear, because for Anime Boston, we're going to do streetwear Inuyasha and Kagome for Friday because it's just comfortable. And the question becomes, is it cheaper and more logical for me to make it or for me to buy it?
Yeah.
And like de-stress it or maybe put patches on and stuff like that. And so that's where it becomes like, that is the thing where I'm like, no, I'm not willing to do this. Not because I can't. It's mostly because it'd be stupid. Like, I never make tank tops. Right. Because why would I? Like, it's a tank top. That's dumb. I sometimes make pants because I'm like, well, Amazon isn't selling a quality and look of pants that I want.
Right.
And I can make better ones.
You can make better pants and you have more control over the material and how like form fitting it is.
Like I technically could have made you buy like a button up linen shirt for Shanks.
Yeah.
But I found that fabric for $1.99 a yard. And I'm like,
to be fair, that is exactly the kind of shit that Shanks would wear. That like that
is cheap like ass barely canvas motherfucking fabric. Yeah.
Barely like considered clothing fabric.
Yeah.
This is something that I can
used to be like a sale.
This is something that I can relate to because this is something kind of like what I was saying before. If a model exists online, why rebuild something?
Yeah.
Why redesign it if it already exists? Unless you outright don't like part of it, right?
Yeah. And you've looked at me a couple times and gone like, why don't we just buy this prop? I'm like, because the quality would be bad. And that's where I come back to with like, like for the streetwear stuff, it's like, no, we're going to buy that shit because like, why? Like I might use the leftover red fabric that I have for Inuyasha to make his like streetwear, like to make his pants.
Yeah.
Because like I have like a pair of pants that I very specifically have in mind and I don't think I'll be able to find them easily.
Right.
But like, yeah.
I don't know. I think it could be fun. That'll be a fun one.
We really gotta get on that though. We've got so many pants to make.
Yeah.
Gotta redo everyone's pants. Gotta do Shanks's pants and Mihawk's pants and Cherry's pants. Everyone's pants.
Yeah.
No one has pants. All right, dear. Here's my last question.
All right.
What do you think, and this can be from me and our friends, what do you think is the biggest misconception when it comes to 3D printing?
The biggest misconception?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess one of the big misconceptions that I've come across is that filament is like an expensive thing,
mm-hmm.
right? I don't think that filament on its own is very expensive, especially nowadays when you can buy like the, I'd say like the baseline, like 3D printing filament is like $15 now, right? You can find like a better version of that filament for like $17 to like $20. And I'm like, that point, just spare the expense.
Yeah.
You might as well. A lot of people who don't get into 3D printing are like, oh, how much do you think that spool of filament is? It's like, this is 300 meters of plastic, right? And that'll print a ton. I think that for Yoru, Yoru is a bad reference because I actually don't know how much filament I went through for Yoru. But I'm going to say at least two and a half spools.
That's a lot of filament.
That's a lot of filament. It is. But for something that's that big, that makes sense. So, like, I guess that's the thing. There's a misconception when it comes to what, how much filament goes into each prop. And I think there's also a misconception amongst, like, my immediate cosplay friends from, like, oh, well, can you change this? And the answer is sometimes no. The answer is sometimes no. Because if it's a model that is being printed from online, right, I've acquired that model in an STL. Right? STL is like the standard 3D printing model, mm-hmm. right? And what is that? That's a standard tessellated lattice, or I think that's right. Can't confirm. But the thing with STLs is that they're just a bunch of little triangles, right? And so if you ever have like a circular, like smooth model that is an STL, it has so many little triangles to make it appear smooth that it's basically like if you were to take that like that file, that STL file, mm-hmm. and then take it and you want to make a modification to it, you have to take it from basically like being already designed and exported as an STL and then put it back into SolidWorks. And SolidWorks looks at this model and goes, oh, this is not a sphere. This is a 7-800 faced polygon. And you want to stick, like, say, for example, like a hole in it.
Polygons.
Like a hole, or like you want to add a ring to it or something like that. That'll be sometimes like what my friends will request me to do. Oh, well, could you add like a little like hole to this or whatever? And it's like, maybe. If I've like acquired like a model that I haven't made myself, you have to reverse engineer an STL into something that is usable in your CAD program. And a lot of the times, if it's smooth and not like a rectangular or like very angular model, it's very hard to do that because the computer is basically like chugging. It's like, this 800 face polygon is too much. Where do you want the hole? Do you want it on face 700 or face 698? Which one are you selecting? I don't know. And I'm like, it doesn't matter which one. It's a sphere. So I need you to just this one and then drill a hole through it. And it's like, are you sure this is a solid piece or is this a surface piece? And it's like, it's solid, I promise. Are you sure? And I'm like, oh my God. So what I'll end up doing a lot of the times when modifications are requested is I leave that piece alone. I'll print a new piece. And I'll either attach it to that one piece, or I'll just, if a modification is a serious modification, I then have to take a model that already exists and that I was happy with and then make it myself. Basically look at one thing that somebody else made that I was happy with and do it myself anyways. That, I cannot lie, can be frustrating. It is endlessly frustrating because it's like I think that people look at it and you're like, well, it's all the same thing. You know, you're 3D printing it. So you designed it and you did this and this. It's like, not every time though. It's something that, like, for example, with the Tessaiga, when you had when you requested modifications, I was like, I mean, this was 20 hours to print, but I guess, yeah, I can change it. It was easy to fix. I went back in the thing and then I changed it because I designed it myself.
So I was able to fix it. It needs to be more curved.
And I was like, yeah, all right. That's fine. This is fine. But if I downloaded that file from somewhere else, it would have been like basically impossible. So,
okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd say that is a big misconception when it comes to that.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. This has been Cosplay Con Crunch. I've been your host, MJ. You can find me on Instagram and TikTok now under the same username of cosplay_Cajun.
And I'm Ryan. I didn't know it was passed over to me right now. Bit awkward.
I had nothing left to say, dude.
Oh, that's fair enough. And I saw the spoons leave your body. And I'm Ryan. You can find me on Instagram as actualry96.
Cosplay Con Crunch is a member of the Rocktopus Network for podcasts. You can find out more about them at rocktopusnetwork.com. We have other podcasts such as Eric Hate Dragon Ball Z, where two best friends try to convince a third best friend to like Dragon Ball Z against all of the odds. There is Tales of Nowhere, a tabletop RPG game where the same cast of characters are forced through a bunch of different role-playing systems and worlds. And lastly, we have Halloween Nation, where the hosts go through all of their spooky stories outside of the month of Halloween. All right, join us next time for whatever we decide to talk about. Have a great week.